Okay, so good. So let us have a look at this evening's questions. Boy, there's a lot here. Maybe I should. Maybe I should start from the bottom to do the one thing yesterday. Okay, let's see what happens. Okay, so dear Ajahn Brahmali, thank you for holding this retreat. It is wonderful to have the opportunity to reflect and learn. With regards to right livelihood, are there certain jobs that lead to greater good karma and those jobs that directly help, for example, such jobs that directly help others, such as doctors, psychologists, teachers, etc.? Thank you. Yes, I would say so. There are certain jobs where you... you know, where you are more of benefit for society than other jobs where you might be for the detriment of society. And of course, if you do something that is beneficial, it is more good karma. But more important than the actual content of the job is your attitude towards it, right? So if you are a doctor and you have the right attitude and you actually reflect that I'm doing this to help my patients, I'm doing this to make a better world, I'm not doing it just to make a living or to become a famous doctor or whatever, but I'm doing it for the right reasons. And this, I think, is one of the important things, is always the attitude, right? Why we're doing things. What is our motivation, the driving force behind these things? It's possible to be a doctor for the wrong reasons and doctor for the right reasons. So this is what I think matters the most. But of course, if you are in a situation like that, where you are a teacher or where you are of great benefit for other people, it is relatively easy to bring up the feeling that you're doing something positive, right? You are contributing to society. But really, you can do that with any job. Because any job, there will be a customer. Any job, there are relations with your fellow employees. And any job, there is a social network that you exist within, right? So because of that, any job can really, it's really a matter of how you use your mind, how you perceive the situation to make it into something positive, something more powerful than just making a living. In fact, I think this is what everybody should do, right? We should all really do that. We should make our lives into a whole life becomes part of the spiritual path. A whole life becomes an act of kindness and generosity. A whole life becomes an act of metta and compassion towards the people and the other beings around us. And if everything we do becomes that, it becomes very powerful, right? It becomes very strong. Because they're always doing the right thing, always heading in the right direction. So this is the kind of the ideal. And it's strange. It is only a matter of perception, right? It's only a matter of how you think. So by thinking a little bit differently, you can actually head in that direction. Your whole attitude to things around you change. Even just your family, right? If you are a parent or obviously we all have relationships with our family one way or another, that too can become an act of giving, an act of kindness, an act of generosity. It can be used to improve our own spiritual practice, and while we do that, it also improves the relationship with the people around us, and everything is kind of lifted up very powerfully. So I think this is very important. Some of the people forget this. It's very important, this idea of using every opportunity, right? Every chance we have to move things forward. That's when it becomes very, the whole thing becomes very, like, powerful, basically. Okay. Dear Ajahn, follow up on the question about forgiveness. Why is it that some incidences and traumas are more sticky than others? Since I have been on the path, I have used wisdom to forgive myself and others. In the beginning, it is usually superficial, but at least that allows me to be able to come closer to the subject or person. Sometimes some things have taken years, but now and then the mind throws it back as if to test me. Yes, yes, that is right. I know if I have been successful, if I don't react at all. Can memories, pleasant or unpleasant, be erased? Is there a delete button? Thank you for a wisdom. I don't know if it is possible to erase things completely, except if you become an arahant and attain parinibbana, then of course it will all be erased. But I don't think so, because remember how memory works by association, right? It's all about association. So what that means is that if you are in a certain mood or a certain state of mind, or you think about certain things, then that whatever state you're in, it associates with an incidents previously where perhaps you were in a similar mood or a similar state of mind, right? So those memories tend to arise. So the way to forget the memories is to lift your mind up to a different level, where you don't really, where you don't actually associate anything from those bad memories in that higher level, because it's just a different type of consciousness, right? If you feel really happy and well, you're not going to think about the misery of the past. Why not? Because there's no association between the two. So this is why when you then develop the path in a positive direction and your mind is more peaceful, more at ease, more happy, you stop associating with those difficult things in the past. And for that reason, you just don't remember them anymore. It's not that they are erased, it's just that the access has kind of been slightly curtailed or even cut off to some extent. And that is why sometimes it comes back, right, with a vengeance. Because one day you feel a bit low or you don't feel so happy, and suddenly these things rush back again as a consequence. But then you understand the power of developing the higher mind. It tends to stop that these things coming back. And that is why, of course, some traumas are more sticky than others, because some traumas are incredibly strong, right? They leave a very powerful impact on the mind. And especially if you are in a place and you go through things that are where perhaps you did something particular, if you did do something particularly bad or something particularly bad is happening to you, and it happens over a long period of time, then it, of course it can become very, very strong. Yeah? And it is more difficult to let go of those things, obviously, because they just have been impacting you for such a long time. But I like the idea that, you know, Ajahn Brahma sometimes talks about is this idea of a positive trauma, right? The idea that if you experience something which is incredibly happy or very joyous or very powerful sense of metta or compassion, if it is very powerful, it leaves a positive trauma on the mind. It is an experience that is so positive you can't forget it, right? Every time you sit down, it kind of comes back to the mind, and it leaves a sense of joy when you reflect on that experience. That is also a very beautiful way of looking at things. Usually we think of trauma as something negative, but this is something positive. It is so powerful, you can't get it out of your mind. And this is what happens if you get into a really powerful state of samadhi. The impact is so strong that you can't really forget it for the rest of your life. So these are the sticky things. So let's try to make more sticky, positive stuff and overcome some of the sticky, negative stuff. Okay. Here, Ajahn, can you please explain why we have to bow once to the Buddha and once to you? You don't have to bow to me. It's really up to you. Do whatever you like. I'm not going to get offended if you don't bow to me. Sometimes we bow a lot, and it's really not necessary to bow quite so much, right? It's not really required. In some monasteries around the world, they bow once in the morning to the Buddha statue, and that's it. There's no more bowing for the rest of the day. And that's fine. It's up to you. If you want to bow once when you come in here in the morning, that's fine. If you don't want to bow at all, that's fine too. There is no rules about this. These are just customs, right? This is what people are accustomed to do, so they do it. That's the only reason. If you feel uncomfortable, please don't do it. If you have a sense of confidence and a sense of faith and it makes you feel good inside to bow, then please bow. This is what bowing really is for. It makes you feel good. Right? If I bow down to the Buddha statue, usually I feel, wow, you know, all these wonderful qualities of the Buddha. And it kind of is inspiring. It's nice to do that. It's nice to look up to something which is more powerful than you, which is a guiding light in your life. Why shouldn't we bow down to something which is a guiding light in our life? It's a nice thing to do. It feels right. So we're not used to this in the West, to bow down. But it, once you get into it, once you get the feeling for it, actually, it's a very positive experience. I don't mean to be disrespectful. I'm just curious. And I know in some cultures, they only bow once to the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha. Thank you. Yeah, so again, it is really, really up to you. Please do as you see fit. Don't feel that you have to fit in and you have to do it because everybody else does it. It is not required. Look after yourself, what actually works for you. That is the most important thing here. Okay. Dear Ajahn, thank you for your brilliant teachings, Ajahn. We have very good karma to hear these teachings from you. May you be as beautiful in our next life too. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, well, we shall see if I'm a really good spiritual teacher, right? I'm not supposed to be here in the next life, right? So that is the problem. Anyway, it is uncertain, so we'll see how things go here. Okay. Okay, if I go for fishing, got the fish and cook for food, is this really bad? What about you don't kill them, but you eat fish, you are indirectly killing fish, don't you think? Thank you. I think this is a strange thing about the way the Buddhist morality works, is that there is a difference between the actual act of killing and the act of eating the flesh. It's as if the very act of killing takes a special kind of mind state, which there's a certain cruelty in that very act of killing things. And you will notice that if you try to kill an animal and you look at your mind while you do that, there is a coldness, a callousness, a hardness in the mind when you do that. And it's not actually pleasant if you are aware of it very carefully. And the more you kill, the more cold and the less feeling you get towards other beings. The more compassion you have, the more understanding you have of the nature of compassion, the less likely you are to kill any living beings. It is different when you buy meat or you buy fish. It doesn't have that sense of killing isn't there in the same way. Yes, you are to some extent supporting the meat industry and all that. Of course, that is true. But it's still different in terms of intention. It's different in terms of mental state. And the only way you can really know that is just to feel the difference, right? Feel the difference between killing and just the act of eating meat. There's a very different feeling to those two things. And from that, you can have some idea that it's different. That doesn't mean, I'm not suggesting you shouldn't be vegetarian. By all means, be vegetarian. I think it's a good thing. And if you're coming from compassion and you're doing it because you feel compassionate to the animals, that in itself can become something very beautiful and it can lift you spiritually as well. But it is still not the same as killing. There is, as far as I can see anyway, there is a distinction there. Okay. Dear Ajahn, can you please talk more about the stages of meditation with metta? Yes, certainly, and I'm going to talk more about that later on in this retreat. I'm going to go through the Anapanasati Sutta again later on this retreat. I did that last year, I think, I can't remember. And that is all about the stages of meditation. I did talk about it at the beginning, right? The various kind of steps you go through. And we're also going to talk about that in terms of the Anapanasati Sutta. But briefly, remember that what this is all about. It's all about developing the mind in the right direction, right? The mind is supposed to move in a certain direction. And what is that direction? It is towards more peace, right? More clarity, less defilements. You're supposed to feel less confused, less deluded, less anger, less desire, right? More joy arising in the mind. So this is, as long as you can see that these things are happening, the good states are increasing, the bad states are going down. If you can see that, you know you're heading in the right direction. You don't have to worry too much about the stages as long as you have a general idea of where you are heading. So that is really what this whole path is about and all the things that we do, whether it's metta, whether it's watching the breath, whether it's just sitting back and enjoying the peace, all of that is about that same thing, giving rise to the wholesome qualities and reducing the unwholesome ones. So this is the idea of improving the wholesome and reducing the unwholesome. This is something you see throughout your life, right? From kind of month to month, year to year, you see this kind of evolution. But you also see it within a single meditation session. So it is like a guide for both what we're doing right here, right now, and also a general guide for your life as well. So that is, I won't say too much more about that, and then we will look at the Anapanasati Sutta later on. I'm also going to go through the Satipatthana Sutta as well, or at least parts of it. And all that is about meditation practice. Okay. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, as a Buddhist laywoman, I have been practicing celibacy for some time now and have found it has benefited my meditation practice immensely. However, I'm often subjected to ridicule by other Buddhists who consider a woman being alone as socially unacceptable. Okay. Can you say a few words, please, as to how we can better support laymen and laywomen who choose celibacy as part of their practice? Okay, so, you know, I think that is not very nice, is it, to ridicule that and not be supportive of that? Basically, it probably means that they don't really understand what is going on. That's really what it means. It is a wonderful thing to do, to live a celibate life, and I think it is a very, as you say, it can be a very strong support for one's meditation practice. And I think certainly in Buddhist circles, we should support anyone who lives like that. I know a number of lay people who live celibate life, and it's great, and it's a really, you know, it's something that we should support. I suppose that sometimes if you are in the wrong circles with the wrong people, they won't understand what's going on. So I guess don't talk too much about your private life, you know. No need to mention that, no need to say how you live. And then people won't have any kind of basis for criticizing you. But I think in the Buddhist community, I encourage every one of you to support each other, right? Whatever we do in Buddhist practice, support each other. Give each other kind of the say, wow, well done, this is wonderful that you're doing that. You're heading in the right direction. You're doing what is good. You're doing what is obviously supportive for meditation. And if once you live a celibate life, you can actually start to do the kind of practices which turn you away from sensuality in a much more powerful way, because there is no conflict there anymore. There's no conflict, part of you going towards sensuality, part of you going away. You can do that more wholeheartedly, so it can become much more powerful. And that is the biggest obstacle for meditation practice in the end, to go really deeply, is sensuality. The craving is what always stops us to go really deep in meditation. That's a wonderful thing to do. So I think that's great. I think that's good. And again, I would just suggest don't talk too much about it to people who don't understand, and then share it with those people who will understand and who therefore will support you. I don't know what else you can do. And we're not going to convert the whole world into celibacy, so we're going to have to see our limitations, I think. Okay. In Ajahn, when I try to do breath meditation, I feel my heart beats faster. Then automatically my mind tries to focus on the heartbeat, and that distracts my breath meditation. Please explain why this is happening. Thank you. This meditation always brings up like reactions in the body, right? This is very common. You become more peaceful. It's not just reactions in the body, but it's also reactions in the mind. And sometimes you don't know whether the reaction is in the body or is the mind or what actually is happening. So just be aware of that. It doesn't matter. If your attention goes to the heart, it's okay. But try not to hold on to it or to cling on to it or to be too concerned about it. Just be aware, right? Just see what is happening here. if it isn't kind of worryingly fast, if there's nothing and your mind is relatively at ease with it, you're not getting too concerned or anything, all you really have to do is just observe, right? See what's happening. People have all kinds of experience in meditation. This is what you hear all the time. I'm feeling my body is expanding, it's contracting, I'm seeing strange lights, I'm seeing all kinds of things, and almost anything can happen in meditation practice. This is perceptions of the mind that is very malleable once you start to become a little bit peaceful. So most likely it doesn't really matter at all. So just sit back and observe. And as you sit back and observe, you don't involve yourself, you don't do anything about it, it will change. It will probably just pass by itself after a while. And then you can move on into meditation practice. So just see what happens. If it is hard to stay with the breath, then just stay with the heartbeat for a while, right? And then when it passes, then go back to the breath again. If it becomes very too much and you're getting afraid or worried or whatever, then open your eyes and just go back to the beginning. Okay, something like that. And see what happens. Dear Ajahn, how do monks keep their egos in check? Okay. Especially learned ones such as yourself. Please forgive me. I am not implying that you have one, or you are one with a big ego, presumably. What are you trying to say here? I've met a monk in Southeast Asia who is very well known, and he is very arrogant. I feel like he had no companions at all. Do lay people who support these monks exacerbate the problem? Thank you. Yes, well, one of the benefits of living in a sangha and living in a group of monks is that your fellow monks are not going to allow your ego to take off too much, right? They will keep you in check. They will say, listen, Venerable, this is, you're going too far or whatever. And this is actually good. If you have a good teacher, he will know that, when you're going in the right direction or the wrong direction, and he will let you know. So this is the great benefit of living in a community. If you live by yourself, sometimes then of course it's much more difficult. It's like you have nobody who to tell you anything. Nobody can watch over you and feel when you're going off the track. And yes, it can be dangerous, right? If you are a teacher and you teach kind of large crowds of people, it's easy for it to go to your head and think that you are some kind of marvelous, wonderful person. I was recently in Indonesia, and Indonesia, the crowds of people were massive. The biggest crowds were almost 3,000 people, right? And then you sit in front of 3,000 people and you have to give a talk. But instead of feeling proud about it or having an ego about it, you learn to actually see it in a good way. So you feel a sense of happiness. I mean, able to share the Dhamma with so many people. What a wonderful thing that is. So it's all about how you perceive it and getting it in the right way. And then actually it becomes a positive thing in your practice rather than a negative thing. So usually you can tell whether it is leading to ego or not by how it affects your meditation practice. Should you support a very arrogant monk? Well, it's hard to say, but generally speaking, you should support where you feel confidence, right? That is basically, I was reading out the other day from the suttas, where you feel confident, where you feel it's good, that is where you should support. Sometimes it can be hard to judge, so don't be too judgmental, but that is basically kind of a general guideline. Where you feel confident, things are going right, that is where you should support. So if you start to feel a bit iffy about that monk, you don't feel comfortable anymore, then you don't have, there's no obligation there for you to support that monk in that case. Okay. Do lay people who support such monks exacerbate the problem? It's really up to the monk to decide, to sort themselves out. Of course, you are allowed to complain, right? You can tell them, this is how I feel about it. You are allowed to say these things. It's okay. You go to the suit as you go to the Buddhist teachings, especially the Vinaya Pitaka, which is all the rules for the monastics. How did those rules come about? Because lay people complained to the Buddha. That's how they come about. Right? It's true. They said, look at these monks, they're doing this. And the Buddha said, okay, can't do that anymore. So please, you know, it's okay to say things, right? What is going on? If you have doubts, you feel something is going wrong, it's okay to say things. But obviously don't say too much. But when there really is a good reason for saying something, that is okay. Okay. Dear Ajahn, I have friends who come from Buddhist backgrounds, both Mahayana and Theravada, and they do not see the role of meditation. How would you describe briefly the role and significance of meditation if you were going to explain this to them? Thank you, Ajahn. Okay, first of all, in the Buddhist teachings, the most important thing is not actually meditation. Meditation is useful. The most important thing in Buddhist practice is sila, is virtue, is kindness, is all these basic things on how we develop our character. And sometimes people misunderstand and think meditation is the most important thing here. And then they don't practice sila, but they do practice meditation, right? And that is getting things the wrong way around. If you're going to choose one or the other, you should always choose sila. That is more foundational and more important. And meditation should come as an additional thing on top of that. So if your friends are already practicing sila, if they're doing the things that are right within that Mahayana tradition, within that Theravada tradition, then that is already wonderful, and you should encourage that. And then you should remind them that the idea of meditation is really to support that sila and take it one step further to also include the virtue of the mind as well. And remind them that if you're able to change the mind, if you're able to kind of perceive things differently, to have more kindness and compassion, the rest of the sila also becomes much more easy, right? So it's actually more easy to be kind. So meditation becomes a support for the ordinary sila, and it becomes taking the whole idea of sila to a deeper level. Plus, it becomes a way to experience happiness and peace and a deeper sense of well-being in life. There's so many great things about meditation. And of course, if you want to take it further, eventually it is also the basis for insight or understanding and seeing reality in accordance to what it actually is. So all of these things are the benefits of meditation practice. But already, please, first of all, rejoice in the fact that they are doing good, right? They're doing sila, they're practicing the right way. That's already a very good thing. That is kind of they're doing the base, getting the basics right. Okay, I'm going a little bit faster today because there are so many questions that we get into trouble, otherwise we'd be hard. So, dear Ajahn, when I do meditate, sometimes clear images start to appear, such as people, rivers, etc. But rarely they appear when I just close my eyes. These images I never thought or haven't seen before, and they don't last too long. Is it just the mind playing up? Yes, it is usually a good sign if you see clear images in your meditation. It usually is a sign that you're becoming quite peaceful. These clear images, they can arise in a peaceful mind. It is very varied from person to person. Some people see these things, some don't. It just varies enormously. So it is usually a good sign. Sometimes these things are also called nimittas. They're nimittas simply because they are a visual sign. Is it the mind playing up? Yes, it is basically the mind playing up, the mind kind of having a bit of fun seeing things. If you have never seen these things before, perhaps they are images that come from a past life, perhaps they come from some past that you don't know anything about, right? And this is where these things often come in. And so if you find it fascinating, you can follow those images for a while. But eventually, you want to put that aside, because images like that are often, they go on and on and on, and there's no end to that. So don't, you know, if you want to play around with it a little bit, that's okay, just for the fun perhaps. But really what you want to do is get back to the breath, get back to the real stillness of the mind. There's still a lot of movement there. If there are images going on, there's still a certain degree of complexity. So you want to reduce things further down, more simple, more still. That is ideally what you want to do. So yes, this is just the mind, as you say, playing around a bit. Okay. Dear Ajahn, in what ways can a couple, husband and wife, help each other in their spiritual journey here? Well, first way is by being kind to each other, right? Number one, be nice to each other. Do all the right things by each other. Be compassionate and understanding. If we can't even be that within a husband and wife relationship, then it's going to make it very difficult to do it for the rest, for other people. But if you have a really good relationship between husband and wife, and some people have that, right, a very solid, very strong relationship, if you have that, it is very useful because it is like a refuge in your life, right? And when things go wrong, it's like the Buddha, like the triple refuge of the Buddha Dhamma Sangha is a similar kind of thing. You have a place of safety, a place that you can go to, a place where you can feel at ease, a place where you can feel relaxed, a place where you are kind of practicing the Dhamma in the right way. So it can be a very good thing to have that. Family can be a place of refuge, which it really should be. When you come back home in the evening, right back to your family, you should be able to feel at ease, feel relaxed, feel that you have support, and that will then help to lift you up and actually bring you forward in your spiritual practice and also in all other things. It's all just about doing all the right things within that relationship, right? Be kind to each other, do whatever it is, give each other room, allow each other to go on retreat, don't be too clingy, allow the other person to kind of do what they would like to do, right? All of these kind of things. And then it lifts both people up. And what the strange thing that happens is that you have a good relationship, but it's not a relationship which is very kind of clingy or very kind of attached, right? It's a relationship where you have the ability, you have the broad-mindedness to give each other room and give each other that possibility to grow in the Dhamma. There is a nice story in the suttas about a couple that were known as Nakula Pita, Nakula Mata. And they were both stream enterers, right? Both of them were stream enterers. In other words, they were very, very spiritually developed. And yet they were very close to each other. They had a very good relationship. And then because of that, they went to the Buddha and said, "Our relationship is so good. We would like not only to be together in this life, but also in the future life." And then the Buddha told them how to do that. So how can you extend your marriage, right, into the future life as well? This is what this is about. Some people say, "Oh no, I don't want that." But if you have a very good marriage, why not? And what the Buddha said, if that is what you want, what you should do is develop the same spiritual qualities. You should have the same sila, the same generosity, the same learning, the same wisdom. And sadhana, maybe. Sadhana might be the last one, right? Okay, thank you, Ananda. That's good. It's good we have some help here. It comes in handy. So these are the five, the sadhana. So this is the same confidence, same faith in the teaching. So confidence, sila, generosity, learning, and wisdom are the five things. So if you have that, the spiritual qualities are roughly the same. You will tend to head in the right direction, in the same direction in the future. Okay, so hopefully that helps. Okay. There's a lot of questions in there. Okay. Ajahn Brahm describes politicians as lacking intelligence. What is the Buddhist view on a region's local politics? Do monastics ever engage with the politicians who share similar world views? For example, the Australian Greens Party tenets of peace, nonviolence, and sustainable living accord very well with Buddhism. Well, I think Ajahn Brahm is a bit tongue-in-cheek, right? I don't think he says these things more as a sense of, for a bit of good fun. I don't think politicians are probably lacking in intelligence. I think often they are, actually are the opposite. Often they are very intelligent people. How are you going to get into these situations unless you are intelligent, right? Everybody wants to get to the top of the, top of everything, and you don't get there unless you are quite smart. I certainly see politicians who are very well spoken, etc. But I think one of the problems with politics is that the system is much more powerful than the individual. So often you start off, you're young, you're idealistic, you want to do something good for the world, right? And then because the system is so strong, the system molds you and it corrupts you on the way. And you learn certain unfortunate habits as a politician, right? And this is often, I think, the problem. I think often people start off as very wholesome and very good people. I think this is more the problem. But again, I'm often very impressed by certain politicians have a lot of integrity, and they actually are, and they say what they think, and they're not afraid, right? It's very easy to become afraid. I'm sometimes impressed by what people are dare to say, right, and to stand up for principles or whatever. I think, wow, that's actually quite inspiring. Yeah. So we need to. I don't think we should have this. Be too negative about politicians. I think in our culture these days, everybody complains about politicians. I don't think that is a very helpful thing to do. Instead, we should ask ourselves, well, how can we, perhaps we need to change the system or whatever, I don't know. But they are people, right? And we need to look at the good sides in our politicians as well. I don't think they are as bad as sometimes they are made out. How much better are we, right? I mean, it's not easy to be in a position like that. It's quite hard. Again, you're molded by the system. I don't think we should be quite as judgmental as we sometimes are of other people, including politicians. Do monastics ever engage with politicians who share similar worldview? Well, monastics, we engage with anyone who is interested. We don't go out and actually seek out politicians and say we want to engage with you, but often politicians invite us, right? And I think that is a very good thing when politicians engage with the Buddhist community. Then Buddhism has a lot of profound understanding and a worldview that is, I think, can be very useful for politicians to tap into. So if they do ask Buddhists, I don't think we should be shy about coming forward and saying, well, this is how things look from a Buddhist point of view. If they ask us, it's okay. If we start to ask them, then especially monastics, then I think it is getting too involved in politics. But if they ask us for support or understand or help, then I think it is fine. But we engage with any politicians, right? We don't really pick out one party or another. In that sense, you have a very broad influence and you're not actually taking too much sides. I don't know if it's useful to take sides. Sometimes it is, but other times it isn't. If somebody wants your support, you should always give it freely, regardless of who they are. Yes. Okay. Dear Ajahn Ramali, I was once emailed the following by a friend. Can you please confirm if the below is in the suttas? Questions to the Buddha. What have you gained through meditation? Buddha replied, I gained nothing but lost anger, fear and ill will. Thank you for your valuable teachings, Mega Metta. I don't recall that particular quote. There is an interesting website on the net called False Buddha Quotes. And that has all these quotes that people attribute to the Buddha and said that Buddha said this, but actually he never said those things. So this is maybe you can go to that site and see if it occurs there. What have you gained through meditation? I don't think anybody ever asked the Buddha that question, as far as I know. And I have read the suttas fairly thoroughly from kind of end to end and back to front or whatever. But he certainly did say that he erased all the defilements. He did say that, as far as I can recall, in a few places. But that is really, but not in that particular context, I think. Okay, dear Ajahn Brahmali, I struggle with the teaching of anatta. I am probably attached to what I am or have achieved. I have spent a long time training, learning and gaining experience, trying to be successful in a career. What advice can you provide, Adam? Thank you. Don't worry too much about anatta. Anatta is a very profound teaching, and more important than worrying about it in a conceptual way or in a theoretical way, try to see anatta in action. Try to see it in your meditation practice. Because what anatta really means is that there are certain things in life that we can let go of, they can disappear, and it doesn't make a difference. In fact, not only doesn't it make a difference, it makes you feel better. So see that in your meditation experience. See as you become more peaceful, as the body fades away, as the hindrances fade away, as the senses start to fade, what does it feel like? And it feels just delightful. It feels very, very nice when things start to become peaceful. Why is that? Because certain things are disappearing. Now those things that are disappearing, they cannot be a self, they cannot be you, right? Because if they disappear, well, and you were that, that means you have disappeared. And this is how, this is one of the basic ways of gaining insight in Buddhism, is seeing that things disappear and then knowing that they are impermanent, that they were suffering, right? You know that they were suffering because they have disappeared and you feel more happy. Right, so that means the body is suffering. If the body disappears and you feel more happy, then the body was suffering. If the senses disappear and you feel more happy, the senses must have been suffering in comparison. So this is how, so see that, see how things disappearing, and then you start to see some degree, a little bit of anatta. You start to see it directly instead of it being a theory. Theoretically, all of these things can be strange and hard to understand. In practice, they become very, very obvious what is going on. Another way to understand anatta or non-self is through understanding the limit of your ability to control things in the world, right? Starting to understand how the world kind of runs according to its own rules, and that your ability to influence the course of events is very, very limited. Things are not going to go as you wish them. Sometimes they go a little bit the way you wish them, and that is dangerous because it gives you the illusion that you're in charge. And the next time they don't, right? And then you despair all the more because you thought you were in charge, because last time you were able to influence things. So that is the other one. And that is incredibly useful to perception to build up. It's a perception that we are not actually in charge, that we're not really able to do very much with the world. It is very useful because it helps us to let go. When things don't go according to plans, we know that that is just the reality of things. And then we are able to just forget about it and not be too concerned about things. There are so many things in life which are difficult to accept, but this is an enormous help in doing that. So just allow these things to gradually kind of build up, right? Gradually you gain understanding of these things. The teaching of anatta should not really be a problem in terms of your training and learning and experience or your success in your career. These things are perfectly combinable with each other. It's not, it doesn't mean that you have to give up all these things. It's just what all it means is that whoever you are, it is conditioned, right? You have been conditioned to what you are now. And all that training, all that career, that has just conditioned you to what you are. It doesn't mean that that's bad. It doesn't mean that you have to let go of that. We are all conditioned in different ways. You could be conditioned to something completely different. That's not really the point. But it is conditioned ultimately. That's really all it means. And we all have to have some sense of identity. Right? Until you reach full awakening, some sense of identity is going to be there. So that then will be your identity. Don't hold on too much to it because it will change and vary a little bit. But that is your identity. And that's okay. And the ideal thing on the Buddha's path is to change your identity so that it aligns a little bit more with the Buddha's teachings. The most important type of identity to have is the identity of a good person, right? You see yourself as good, as virtuous, as kind, as generous. This is the most important sense of identity. So we change, we kind of use the Buddha's teachings to even those things that we are ultimately have to let go of. In the beginning, we use them to build up a sense of identity around the positive things. We all have to have some source, some degree of attachment in our life. That's just the way things are. But if we are going to attach, and attach to the good things in life, attach a little bit to being virtuous, attach a little bit to, you know, to the good companions in the Buddhist life, that is where your attachment should be. That is where your identity should be. If you're able to combine that identity as a person who's doing a career, etc., with the identity of being doing the right thing in life, then there's no problems there. Yeah. Okay. Most respected Ajahn, it's very nice. You practice generosity and metta by way of life. Will it be too much to ask you to repeat this retreat in November, but only for newcomers, not for retreat junkies, as per Ajahn Brahm? Many junkies are here. Okay, there are so many who missed out on places in retreat due to the competitiveness of registration. So place a rule not for members who has done more than a 9-day retreat. In November there is a window at Ajahn Brahm. I think Ajahn Brahm only cancelled his retreat last year. I think this year he will be doing it again, I think. Or was it this year it's cancelled? It's cancelled this year. Okay, this year it's cancelled. Okay, I'm getting things wrong. But the year after he will be doing it again. Okay, thank you for a wonderful retreat. Okay, I don't know. I can't really answer. It depends on so many factors. It depends on, I would have to speak to Ajahn Brahm. It depends on whether I'm busy at that time. Already, my schedule after the rains is already filling up and all kinds of things are happening here. And so it's not really up to me 100%. So let's just see what happens. So I'll check with Ajahn Brahm and see what he says. And if there is a lot of people who think that's a good idea, then maybe. But I can't unfortunately not give any guarantees about that. Okay. At 5 p.m. tea time, why can we eat cheese but not milk chocolate? Okay. These are the kind of questions we debate endlessly in monasteries. What exactly are you allowed to have? What can't you have, right? This is kind of the areas. What are the gray areas? What can you just kind of squeeze in and what can you not squeeze in, right? So the idea of eating cheese, we don't actually have cheese at Bodhinyana Monastery. We never eat cheese there. But the cheese is like a grey area of Vinaya, and in Thailand it is often considered as acceptable for monastics to eat cheese. In other countries like Burma and Sri Lanka it is not considered acceptable. And the reason why there are these grey areas is because some of the rules that existed 2,500 years ago, it is hard to interpret, right? The Pali word for this substance that was allowable at the time of the Buddha is called Navanitang. And nobody knows exactly what Navanitang is, right? It's just the name. And you have some idea because it's based on milk and all this kind of thing. So it's kind of ballpark. It's something like perhaps it's more like butter, right? Perhaps it's more. So nobody really knows exactly what it is. And because of those gray areas, that is why these things are allowed. But milk is another strange thing. It is not entirely clear whether it is allowable or not. Probably isn't, but maybe it is. So I think that if people want to have milk chocolate, I don't think it's personally, I don't think it is a big issue. But sometimes it's like you have to have rules, right? You have to have some guidelines. Sometimes it's easy to say, well, these are the rules, and everything else is kind of out. It makes it easy. It makes it kind of nice. If you keep on stretching things back and forth, and you can keep on doing that forever, then it just keeps on, you keep on thinking about these things. So that is really the only reason. But, there is nothing, no real reason in principle why you couldn't have milk chocolate, in my opinion. Anyway. Dear Ajahn, my vyapada is fear. Okay. Nivarana is perhaps, okay. Fear of making mistakes, fear of being wrong, of criticism, of blame. I see how I try to manipulate things, do things as perfectly as possible to avoid criticism, etc. I see that fear is strongly bound to the sense of self, of I. I see it as a projection to future that may or may not eventuate. Yes, fear starts as a queasy little worry or anxiety when thinking of what has to be done. And then before I know what, I've grasped it and it just seems to grow. How do I work with it? Please help untangle this tangle. With much gratitude and metta for the teachings. Okay, so fear, this is very common, right? Everybody has this to some extent. We want to please other people, we want to please, and we want to make sure we do get the right thing, and then we get praised, right? We get attached, we are attached to praise, and we don't want blame. This is just life. And this is a problem. The more attached you are to these things, the more manipulated you can be by people around you as well. If people know that you are kind of a sucker for praise, right? And you can't handle blame. They can kind of manipulate you around that. And the same thing if you, with all things in life, if they know that they kind of can control, they can, once there are certain things that you're attached to, people can control you to some extent. And this is becomes then a problem. So remember, these are the worldly dhammas, right? These are called the loka dhamma in the suttas. Things like praise and blame and all these things, praise and blame and fame and notoriety and happiness and unhappiness and So these, what's the last one here?
Profit and loss,
thank you. It's good we have all these knowledgeable people here who can sort of keep things. You should know about that. You're an accountant, aren't you? That's okay. So we have accountants, that's what comes in very handy here. So remember this, and this is always problematic. So what we try to do is you try to move, you try to build up a sense of independence inside of you. And this is one of the great side effects of the practice, is that you actually become more independent as a person. You get more a sense of confidence in yourself. You get more sense of that what the rest of the world does doesn't matter so much. If other people blame you, it's not your problem, it's their problem, right? Why on earth would they blame you? You know in your heart that you're doing the right thing. You know that even if you haven't done 100% the right thing, that you tried your best. You can't do any better than that. It is not... Remember, what is good in the world, what is right to do in the world, is not what is right according to what other people think. It is right according to a very clear ideas of ethics, right? Where are you coming from? Are you coming from wholesome states? Are you coming from a sense of metta, compassion, from a sense of, from all the right things inside? And if you are, you are doing the right thing. Whether other people blame you or not is irrelevant. And this way, you gain a sense of integrity. You are doing the right thing, regardless of what the world thinks you should do. If you don't have that, it means you can be manipulated. And sometimes you can be manipulated into doing things which actually are wrong. And that is where things really start to, don't function anymore on the Buddhist path. So you have to try to not to worry about what other people think, right? If they blame you, the more you practice the Buddhist path, the more sense of integrity you have that you're doing the right thing, the more you can disregard the other people blaming you and other people saying you haven't done what is right. It's just a bad habit, really. That's all it is. And as you kind of lift yourself up, as your meditation becomes more profound, as you develop this path, you will... Gradually, you will shed these things and you will leave them behind you, and it won't matter anymore. One of the reasons why somebody like Ajahn Brahm is capable of telling so many outrageous jokes and all this kind of stuff is because he doesn't care what other people think about him. If he did, he wouldn't tell all those jokes, right? And he really doesn't care. And this is kind of, that makes him very free, right? He can basically do anything, and if the rest of the world blames him, well, he can always just disappear into a cutie somewhere and meditate, so it doesn't really matter. This is freedom, right? Liberation from other people trying to kind of, work you as a kind of puppet on a string or something like that. There's no attachments anymore. You can't manipulate Ajahn Brahm. Those of you who know him well will know it's impossible to manipulate Ajahn Brahm. At least if it is overt manipulation, if he feels it, then you can't manipulate him. If you are so smart that he doesn't feel it, maybe you can. But once he feels it, there's no way he can be manipulated, because that is just not how he operates. He's a very free kind of person. And you know that when you live with somebody for a long time, you know a lot about that person and how they work and how they function. And this is where you are heading as well. By overcoming these things, you're heading towards a sense of freedom, whereby the world cannot manipulate anymore. And you have the inner compass, which guides you in the right direction, and everybody else becomes irrelevant. Okay, we'll do a few more. It may go a few minutes over time today, because we have so many. If I don't do them, we probably just keep heaping things up. So please, of course, if you don't want to stay or you want to go back, please do so. That is always the case, by the way. Dear Ajahn, I have a family member who has a very high ego and very delusional thoughts, always like to brush shoulders with high society, always think very highly about himself, and let down others. Also believe this is the only life, so enjoy. I do feel deeply for this person. How can I help? Thank you. Good question. How can we help? Sometimes we can't help others. This is one of the things I was just talking about. Sometimes in life we know that there's limits to what we can do. We can only do so much. The world goes according to its own cause and conditions. And sometimes we just have to allow the world to go that way, including other people. And the best way to help others is to be a good example. People go through these periods where they have very high opinions about themselves, usually when people are young, right? I mean, I was no different when I was young. I was just the same. You know, you tend to be a bit arrogant. You tend to think you know everything. You tend to think that basically you're overestimating yourself quite a lot when you're young. Not everybody, but it's a tendency when one is young. I'm sure we've all been there to some extent. Sometimes you just have to be patient, right? You just have to wait to do the right thing. Do what is good and do what is right. And that means that they have an example. It means that they have something to fall back upon when they one day start to realize that they're going wrong. Then they have something else in their life that they can actually fall back upon, and they can come to you and ask for advice or whatever. And then you have something to say. But very often, there is not much you can do. Once a certain person has a certain view of the world, right, they don't believe there is any future life, usually you can't change those things, because usually these things are often quite deep-seated. Not always. Sometimes they're not deep-seated, in which case they may change, but often they are. These are habits we have, right? This is one of the interesting things about views. We often think that views are like something we have arrived at through rational inquiry. This is my view. Rebirth doesn't make any sense because this is the rational truth. That's what we think. But actually, very often, these things are not about rational inquiry at all. They are about habits. They are about the conditioning of people around us. That is why we have those views. And I've seen that so many times. People change from not believing in rebirth to actually accepting it. And which one is rational? Which one is not? And you can't really say one is more rational than the other. There are good reasons for believing in either one, right? But it's just the conditioning has changed. So now you believe in it, and you didn't believe in it before. It's very, very useful to remember that. Remember that your views are conditioned. It doesn't mean that your views are wrong, but it means that they can change very easily. So I think basically you're going to have to be just patient and just to allow things to happen, just to do the right thing. Not to be too attached to how this person behaves and what they are like. It's very hard to change other people. I always like to remind people that remember how hard it is to change yourself. And when you remember how hard it is to change yourself, you don't place very much demands on other people. Dear Ajahn, you did mention that in the suttas it is not especially mentioned against taking alcohol. When and who added the fifth precept of Sura Merya Madhyapa Madatana? It is not mentioned in certain contexts where you might think it should be, but it is mentioned in other contexts. It is in the suttas, but it is a little bit less central than the other precepts, and that is why it is. This is what we're talking about basically here. So, but it is there. For example, I think in the 8 precepts are mentioned in the suttas, and it would be in there. So it is as part of the 8 precepts, and that they are mentioned in quite a few places. So it is there, but it's not quite as central as the other ones. So definitely, it is not recommended from a Buddhist point of view. It is definitely recommended not to take alcohol or any other kind of drugs. Dear Ajahn, it is okay not to have any relationship with a person who has hurt you. Yes, it is okay. Yes. It is. We can choose our relationships as we like, right? You don't have to. You don't have to kind of do things. If it is somebody who is a family member, or somebody who perhaps you feel that you should have some communication with, then what you can do is just withdraw enough to feel that you are able to kind of get clarity about what is going on. And if you have a little bit of extra energy, or you feel that you have the ability to be of assistance, then maybe sometimes you can meet them. If you have a feeling that you want to heal the relationship and you have the ability you feel to do that, then it might be a good thing to do. You might be able to help yourself and also help the other person. But certainly there is no obligation to be with people who have hurt you. And it's quite okay to withdraw from that kind of relationships, right? If you're married to somebody who is very difficult, it's okay to get a divorce, right? I mean, if you can change the marriage and you can make it into something better and you can grow spiritually, great. But if it is too much and you can't do that, of course a divorce is perfectly okay from a Buddhist point of view. We shouldn't allow ourselves to, you know, to put ourselves in harm's way in that way. Yeah. Okay. Ajahn, with regards to abandoning of thoughts of ill will, desire and confusion, would you please talk a little bit about confusion? The mind stays busy trying to figure it out, often leading nowhere and more often to suffering. What is a wiser way of understanding confusion and what to do when it arises? Okay, so remember that when the mind tries to figure all kind of things out, and this often happens in meditation because you feel that when the mind becomes peaceful, you can feel that it becomes more powerful, right? So there's always that kind of draw towards, now is the time to figure it out, because now my mind is kind of powerful. I can think about all these things and I have much more clarity than I ordinarily have. I'm sure many of you have had that experience in meditation, and you think you should think about things. But don't do that, because the clarity will also be there after the meditation. So remember, now you are there to use that power to take it even further, to go further. Don't waste the opportunity with thinking about these things now. Remember that there's even more power available after the meditation is finished. So you coach yourself a little bit. Remind yourself, this is not the right time. And in this way, you kind of incline the mind in the right direction. It is not always easy. Sometimes the mind is very stubborn. It wants to think about these things. And then, if that is the case, then ask yourself, what is the cause? What is going on here? What is it that the mind is trying to figure out? Right? If it is a relationship problem, then sometimes it's just a matter of forgiving. And by forgiving people, you can let go. And then you can move on as a consequence. So sometimes understanding the root cause can enable you to do something which can eliminate that problem, and then you can be more peaceful. But a lot of the time, it is just the mind wanting to wander around, think about this and that. Part of the problem is that you're not getting enough happiness in the meditation. If the meditation doesn't give you happiness, the happiness will be sought somewhere else. And thinking is one way that the mind seeks for happiness. Right? If the present moment is not pleasant, if your legs are aching, just everything is miserable, your mind is going to go off into fantasy land. Maybe future, maybe past, or just fantasies, because it doesn't want to be present. The more beautiful and pleasant and delightful the present moment is, the easier it is just to stay here in the present moment. This is what all these things are talking about, finding the ease in the body, right? When the body is really at ease and relaxed, it actually feels quite good. You feel happy. You feel, wow, it's nice to be here, right? It's a much more pleasurable feeling than you normally have in daily life. In daily life, you get a bit stressed out. Tensions arise in the body, and they tend to stay there often for long periods of time. Here, you have a chance to relax absolutely completely. Feel that feeling, what it feels like to be 100% relaxed. It feels nice, right? It feels good. And then the mind comes into the present moment because it just feels good to be here. So this is really, in the end, that's what we all have to do. The meditation has to feel good, and that will push away this kind of confusion, mind thinking, all this kind of stuff. There are other types of confusion, the confusions about not understanding Buddhism properly or not understanding the path properly. In that case, it's just a matter of keep on studying, keep on trying to understand the Buddhist teachings, and that will eventually resolve itself. Keep on trying to understand meditation practice, understand what are the wholesome qualities, what are the bad ones, and gradually any doubt or confusion will be resolved in that way. There are five hindrances. The fifth one is doubt, and that is resolved through inquiry, through asking, through finding out what are the wholesome qualities in life. Okay, only two more questions. That's good. So, dear Ajahn, could you please explain how to find a sutta or topic in the Anguttara Nikaya or Sanyutta Nikaya? Is it straightforward numbering? It is straightforward numbering for the Majjhima Nikaya. Thank you. Okay, so the suttas in the Anguttara Nikaya and the Sanyutta Nikaya, they are divided into groups, right? Anguttara Nikaya is translated as numerical discourses, and that is because they are according to numerical topics. You have the group of fives, the group of six things, the seven things, right? So you start, the first group is the ones, then you have the twos, you have the threes, all the way up to the elevens. And within each of those categories, you have a large number of suttas. So, for example, in the threes, you have something like 250 suttas. In the fours, you have maybe 300 suttas or whatever. There's a large number of suttas within each category here. In the Sanyutta Nikaya, it is grouped according to topics. So you have the group about the five aggregates, the five khandhas. You have the one about the six senses. You have the group about dependent origination. You have the group about the path. You have the group about the bhujang, the factors of awakening. You have the group about devas, about gods. You have the group about King Kosala. There's 56 groupings altogether. And then within each of those groupings, again, there is a large number of suttas, ranging from the shortest one, maybe 10 suttas, up to about 250 suttas or something like that. So this is how it is structured. And once you know the structure, if you want to find a particular topic, the English translations of the suttas have a very good index at the back. So look up the index. It's very, very, very useful. And look up any particular topic you're interested in. Or what you can do is just open it up at a random page and start reading. If you don't like what you read, turn the page, try something else. Right? Don't force yourself to read things you're not interested in. Find something that you like, that you enjoy. Okay, last one for today. Dear Ajahn, above the entrance to the meditation hall at Bodhinyana Monastery, there is a symbol in the form of a wheel having eight spokes. Can you explain this symbol for us, please? With thanks and much respect for your patient explanations. Okay, the eight-spoked wheel is the wheel of the Dhamma Chakra. And this is when the Buddha starts off his teachings. He says that he has set in motion the wheel of the Dhamma in the world. The first sutta of the Buddha is called the Dhamma Chakra Pavattana Sutta, the setting in motion of the wheel of the Dhamma. So this is what you're seeing there, is the wheel of the Dhamma. Now, exactly why it has eight spokes, presumably because of the Eightfold Path, right? That is probably the reason why it has that. The number of spokes can vary depending on what it symbolizes. But of course, the path is perhaps the most important thing to keep this wheel rolling. As long as people practice the path, it means there will be people realizing the results of that path. And it is through realization of the path that the wheel keeps rolling. That is how the Dhamma is transmitted from one generation to the next, by the realization of these teachings. So that is basically what it is. And it's quite interesting. One of the amazing things, I don't know if you have seen the national flag of India. National flag of India is yellow, white and green background. And in the foreground, there is that precisely that same wheel, right? It's a Buddhist wheel of the Dhamma is found in as a national symbol of the Indian flag. So the Buddhist influence is very strong in India, even though the number of Buddhists in India now is very small. The Buddhist history is so strong in India that many of these symbols have actually survived in Indian society, even to make it into the flag as such. So that is exactly the same wheel you find in the Indian flag. Symbol of this thing rolling on in the world. Okay, so that is all for this evening. So we'll see you again tomorrow morning.